Ooh, that is, that's new. Okay. Good evening. Welcome to our second in a series of forum organized by the Arlington Civic Federation Task Force in Governance and Electoral Reform. I'm Chris Wimbush, the chair of the task force, or TIGER. TIGER was recruited by the Civic Federation in response to legislation signed into law, which will enable Arlington, if it so chooses, to use ranked choice voting in electing our county board. The Civic Federation decided, in initiating TIGER, that it was proper to make a wider examination of Arlington's form of governance, elections, and mechanisms for public engagement. And our resolution establishes TIGER's parameters in the following way. The task force will examine, potentially make recommendations on reforms which may include structural reform through district representation and or multi-member synchronous elections, the size and pay of our county board and or school boards, ranked choice voting for county board and school board general elections, the future role of primaries and caucuses, options for alternative electoral mechanisms besides first past the post and ranked choice voting, and the possibility of term limits. In this series of discussions, we will hear a variety of views about governance and electoral options and issues. At this time, the TIGER task force is in listening mode, and we have yet to formulate any recommendations on any of the matters before us. And we have members who come to this work with a varied range of opinions and views. Tonight, we will discuss the work of the City Club of Portland, which has issued recommendations for that city for a through a multi-year process addressing many of the issues identified by Arlington's Civic Federation for TIGER. And so I will turn this over to Dave for introductions of tonight's panelists and speakers. And so Dave, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you all for joining us this evening.
Okay, and this is basically these guys have been part of the Portland City Club process for thinking about Portland's form of government. Portland, like many West Coast cities, has a regular process of charter review. And then the Portland City Club, which is kind of a peer organization to the Civic Federation, a private organization, did a great deal of work to develop recommendations for the official Portland charter review group. They have presented a report. The process has been somewhat slowed by the COVID problems, and is not moving forward with any great speed right now. But their report to the Charter Commission indicates that they've been looking at very much the same issues that face Arlington, and it's a very impressive report. And tonight we're going to hear about it. Thank you for joining us. And they are Mark Stefan and Nathan Naimont. I'm sorry.
So it sounds like I should get started. Okay. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Chris. And I want to thank my co-presenter here, Nathan. I'm going to load up some slides or share some screen here with some slides that eventually Nathan will take over, and he also will be doing a series of going through a series of slides as well. Just as a favor, it was sort of asked at the beginning, but I'll ask it again just in case anybody that didn't hear this, is it helps both of us in our speaking if your mute button is on. So that there's no sort of distortion in any sort of way that throws us off, that's appreciated. So with that said, let me go ahead and share my screen. And hopefully everyone is seeing this now. I mean, basically this is a version of a presentation that we gave to at least one neighborhood association here in Portland, and have also done informal conversations with a variety of people around Portland. And certainly City Club has actually done a great deal to promote the report that we helped put together with a research committee for City Club. It's a It's a civic nonprofit basically here in Portland, focused on Portland Metro concerns. I think as a starting place to this, let me see. I'm not getting, there we go. So hopefully everyone now sees the second page. If you're still seeing the first page, Nathan, you let me know, because we had this problem before. Really what we've got here in City Club are two reports, not one. And we're going to talk mostly about the second one of these, because it really is the most relevant to your concerns. But we wanted to give you the context for us in Portland and sort of how this all came about. So there's also another report, which I'll talk briefly about. Nathan will be giving a lot of the sort of core details around election reforms and sort of what came out of the report and out of the work of the research committee. It was a group of around 9-10 people who worked on this for, altogether about 8 months to put together the report. And if you haven't had a chance or there's not been a link sent out to it, you can get this online easily enough. Okay. So three key sort of aspects of this presentation. What prompted our reports and sort of kind of how they evolved, so you have some context for it in the Portland case. Then a bit more details about sort of why the Rethinking How Portland Votes report, which is the one that we were involved with that I chaired and Nathan participated in. And then Nathan will go into the details around electoral voting method reforms. Now, I should mention, and I should have mentioned this right at the beginning, if you have a question about, a clarifying question about something that we're talking about, please don't hesitate to ask. Other questions, sort of questions for discussion or commentary, please, if you could, hold it on until the end. But if you have a clarifying question, it's always good to get that while we're moving through the material. All right, so why the initial report? Because as I mentioned, we were involved in putting together the second report for Portland, focusing on Portland's governments. Basically, this came down to a concern among many, not only in City Club, but around the city of Portland, that the government wasn't working, our city government wasn't working as effectively and fairly as possible. It wasn't doing the job in a variety of capacities that we had hoped it would do. And so there was a need to sort of rethink this. Now, I should say that the desire to reform certain aspects of city government have occurred off and on for decades in Portland. In some respects, some of what we're going to talk about today is nothing new. It's been talked about before, but there's still maybe even a growing interest in making some changes in how things are run and how we elect city officials in the city. So really quickly, I'll give you sort of the background and the conclusion, because first we got the conclusion for the first report, right? The key one was moving away from a commission or commissioner form of government to a council manager form of government, where you'd have a mayor and then a council who combined do all the legislative functions for the city. And then you have a city manager working with the mayor who would do all the executive sort of functions for the city. What we have now is one of the few left for a city of our size, commissioner form of governments in the country. We may be, in fact, one of the last ones for any government the size, with a city the size of ours or larger. So many of you may be familiar with this, but the basic idea is that in Portland, the commissioners each not only have a legislative function, but they have an executive function as well. They have bureaus that they run. They basically, the bureaus, the mayor decides which of the council members will take which of the bureaus. And so, police is taken by this council member, and waterworks is taken by this other one, and they have an executive function that goes above and beyond their legislative function. If you want to have a conversation about why that existed in the first place, we could talk about that history that goes back to the Progressive era. But basically, we've had this for 100 years plus now, I think. And there have been attempts to move away from the commission form of government, commissioner form of government, off and on for a number of years. But there seems to be a bit more energy now for this. And that was one of the key conclusions for City Club, was that in fact, we do finally move away from that and move towards a council manager system. There was also an understanding in the first report that the size of our city council, given the size of the city, which is what, maybe 750,000, 800,000, that we needed to increase the city, the size of the city council, moving from the five that we've got now to a much larger number, well, to a larger number, a little bit left undefined, nine city council members, 12. It may be unwieldy after a certain point, if you're talking about 15, 20, 25, but certainly at the number we're at now, it has been considered by many to be too low. And the main argument there is not surprising, it's just one of representation. The idea that few people representing the interests of this large of a city is too few. Goes back to ongoing arguments made in Arlington County, for example, and other parts of the country about what's the right size, what's the right balance in terms of an effective city council that's also a good, you know, representative city council. The third point that was made in the first report, and if you go back and look at that, I mean, that's also available online, you'll see this, is that they argue that we should change how council members are elected. We should move away from the current sort of at-large system across the entire city of Portland, and we should do something different. The problem there is that if you look at the report, all of the research in the report and the analysis is about conclusion one and conclusion two. It's really not about conclusion three. So they draw this conclusion and they do it arguably without really having enough data to do so. And they recognize that really upon the release of that report, or maybe even before it was finally released, it was sort of understood, you know, we didn't really dig into this the way we should have. And so the decision was made, you know, to expand and move to create a whole new report that really would take conclusion three and really kind of step back, think about that question that went with it, and then readdress it in a bigger fashion. And so that's where the report that we were involved with. So this is where Rethinking How Portland Votes, our report, came in. And, you know, it was an attempt to extend what was said in the first report and to build on it. It is important, and Nathan's been good about reminding me of this, to point out, is that we wouldn't have had this conversation about election reform if there hadn't been the original impetus for the focus on changing the form of government. In fact, they go hand in hand. As far as we know, there's no one who's recommending election reforms with electoral sort of reforms without also changing the form of government. If you don't change the form of government, but you move to things like districts and you expand the number of council members, you run up against some real problems with sort of little sort of fiefdoms in different parts of the city that connect with the bureaus, the different bureaus. So it becomes potentially problematic. So basically they go hand in hand. Portland, those of us who sort of see the need for change, Portland needs to have a different form of government, but then in turn, it needs to also have a different electoral structure as well. And they can go with each other, and they in fact really do go with each other. Okay, so what are our broad conclusions? I'll lay out the conclusions now, then Nathan's gonna dig into some of the details. I mean, a big part of this, and this gets to also the form of voting itself, is reforming the election so that we eliminate the primary. We'll make the argument here in a minute about why we think that's so important, but we do. We think eliminating the primary is important. Moving to just general elections is really critical. We also make an argument not only for individual districts throughout the city versus the at-large system we have now, but we also make an argument for multi-member districts. And this is one that we kind of worked through quite a bit, and we can talk more about why, you know, what a multi-member district is. It's also referred to as a multi-election winners. There's some real pros to it, more pros than cons from our perspective. a third broad conclusion is that we felt like even with the work that we did and trying to reach out to some community groups and trying to get a sense of their perspective about these reforms, it was nowhere near enough and that really more needs to be done. So any attempts at reforms need to be sort of increasingly involve marginalized communities in the city of Portland to get their buy-in. The legitimacy of these changes are going to be much stronger if that buy-in occurs with marginalized communities. That means reaching out to them and really talking with these communities. And this was a process itself in putting together the report that we can talk about if you're at all interested. And so what we did was just the beginning. Our hope with this report and the first report is to, as was pointed out by Dave, is to affect the charter reform process here in Portland. It's an ongoing thing right now. It happens basically every 10 years. And we have an opportunity to make some substantial changes right now. And those of us in City Club and certainly involved with the support really are hoping that that occurs. There's also the possibility to affect ballot measures. This is a state, like many West Coast states, that is very initiative happy and referendum happy. And that's another vehicle for this, especially if the charter reform doesn't really make much progress. There's the possibility of that. So that finishes what I'm going to focus on. I'm going to let Nathan sort of open up his slides as I'm stopping my share, and he'll be able to take over the other details. And while he's doing that, while he's sharing that, I'll look over here and see about the questions that came up, because I wasn't looking at the chat. Actually, it didn't even let me know that there were questions until I finally got the share off. Really quick. Let me see if I can get him back.
That's me.
Yeah, no, that's you. But I'm trying to get the. Oh, there they are. Okay, I'm looking for the questions that were asked. So I want to quickly answer them before you jump in because they're clarifying questions.
Okay.
The mayor would be the chair of the council. Their function is to chair the legislative process for the council, but also work with the city manager to manage the city. So they have, kind of like a president, right? They have both the legislative and the executive functions. Looks like Nathan already partly answered. Okay, sort of answered that. Oh, sorry, I didn't even look at that.
Sorry, Mark.
Yeah. And then you answered both of those. Okay, I'm done. It's go for it.
Okay, great. Let me just get this going the way that it will work for you guys. So again, my name is Nathan Naiman. I was served on the committee with Mark. Just a little bit of background before I just jump right in. I'm relatively new to the Portland metro area. I kind of cut my teeth on California politics. And I was very much involved in the creation of district elections in San Francisco, and went through this process it's pretty intense for quite a while. So I think I have a little bit more of experience in the nitty gritty part of this, getting it passed and then actually implementing a change from at-large elections to district elections, and then moving on to ranked choice voting. They used to call it instant runoff voting, but there's nothing instantaneous about ranked choice voting. It takes time. So just following up from where Mark left off, one of the key concerns that we talked about in our group was voter participation. And we know that with primaries, there's a very much lower turnout than the general elections. Most people are not paying attention to the fact that there is a primary, and the people that get most motivated to come out in primaries are people that pretty much are involved in the political discourse, the chattering class. People that have something to gain or lose to make sure that their representative is the one that is in office. So what we've learned through the data, and the data is pretty significant around the country, that in primaries, it's a disadvantage to the Portland voters of color, where they, again, do not necessarily participate in the primary, where the final decision for who will be voted into office is made at the general election. Also, primary voters are older. And again, those primary voters, as it says down there, may not really select the representatives that really reflect all of Portland adults. So again, the key here, again, is voter participation and maximizing it and making sure that all voters, everyone that's qualified to vote does come out and vote. You can see the numbers there going back to 2016 and 2018. The difference in the number of voters in the general election and the primaries. Here's a little bit more of a graph that shows you some more of the distinction here of folks that actually vote in the primary elections versus the general election. So again, the numbers, the colors and the numbers are pretty pretty stark. So you can see the need for, from our opinion, eliminating primaries and just going to a general election that everyone will participate in. Let me just get this here. So again, going to the method of voting, we came out in favor of ranked choice voting. As a matter of fact, the mayor's race in New York City right now is ranked choice voting for the first time, and five candidates will be selected, are available to be selected, or five choices are available for voters in New York City now. Again, ranked choice voting, and you know, it's compatible either with a single winner or multi-winner elections, which Mark just discussed. And again, ranked choice voting, it's gaining traction nationwide. It does require a significant amount of education. I can't tell you how challenging it was to make sure that in every language available, that all the language that were available allowed people to be educated on how to vote. Some people think, all right, I'm going to vote for I have only one choice, and I'm going to give that person all my votes, whether it's three votes or five votes, whatever is ultimately decided upon. That's called bullet voting, and that particular ballot is discarded because it's not done properly. So again, it's very, very important to make sure that there is a very, very robust and culturally sensitive education process that will explain ranked choice voting to the general population. Quite frankly, it should last at least a year, and it should definitely involve some of the more marginalized communities, especially those where English is a second language. So again, with ranked choice voting, the way that it works is that, again, people rank their candidates in order of preference. The way that it works is that if no one gets 50 plus 1% of the votes, then the person with the least amount of votes gets disqualified, and his or her remaining votes get transferred up to the next choice. And you keep going through this cycle until one person comes out with 50 plus 1% to win the election. This works, again, this works with multi-district voting as well. There's also some other forms of voting listed below. It's cumulative voting, limited voting. There's also, I have on this slide and this deck, a couple more explanations on limited voting and cumulative voting. You can read that for yourself. But again, what this all comes down to is making sure that people are educated on the process in which they can vote. And also, again, making sure ultimately that, you know, the primaries are eliminated. I'm going to go back to previous slide, and I'm going to turn it back to Mark, if you have anything to add. And then I guess we'll be ready for some questions.
Great, thank you, Nathan. And you know, one thing that Dave or Chris, whoever, if you want to redirect us back to the slides, or if you want to, I think you actually have a copy of those slides. So if you want to share them, that's fine by us. But we can also just call them back up if people have a question about something you might have just looked at. The only thing I was going to mention was the multi-member districts in a little more detail, and just talk about why our committee recommended them. Because we went, my memory of this, and I could be wrong, it's been a little while, but my memory is that the committee went back and forth about sort of whether we elevated multi-member districts as sort of more appropriate than single member districts. There were more pros than cons in that regard. And we really saw a lot of, actually, if you're talking about ranked choice voting, we saw a lot of pluses to single member districts as well. So we weren't ignoring their improvement over an at-large system. But the idea behind multi-member, really one of the key ideas in my mind at least, is the way it changes the whole campaign process for members. And it allows for potentially people within that district to focus on, let's say, one of three candidates from that multi-member district and assure that they get their votes behind that person. And that person may be a person of color, but they may have other sort of distinguishing features as well, which help to diversify the council, the city council in this case. What's also true is that in multi-member systems, you tend to see less polarization, less conflict-oriented campaigning, because you don't know if your negative comments about someone else that you're running against is actually going to help a third candidate, not you. And so that effect in multi-member districts is pretty fascinating to watch play out as well. And it's a real positive thing from our perspective. Better informed, less conflictual, more, less negative advertising. These things also are a part of this. But the key part, as I started with the multi-member districts, is that they can bring some leverage for increasing the diversity of a city council. In this case, or maybe in your case, maybe it would be a county council or something like that. That was really it. I think Nathan otherwise covered what mattered to us, but we're happy to take more comments or questions for clarification about kind of where things are at in Portland.
So yeah, we wanted to make sure there was more time for questions than us just talking to you. So I guess, Chris, will be the moderator.
I will moderate. So what we'll do is I'd ask folks to please use, if you click reactions on your screen, and use the raise hand button. That generally tracks folks in order when they raise their hand, and we'll tick through. I'd ask that if you're a Tiger member or a member of the public who's joining us tonight, please introduce yourself. However, whatever identifiers you choose to use, and in terms of your civic association or how you came this way, but it'd be great to just very briefly learn who you are. But I'll call you out as I see hands. So we'll start first with John.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chris, and thank you for the folks from Portland. So I have three quick questions that I'd like to ask that hopefully won't take too long. First question, a lot of the variables that Arlington, Virginia is now mulling will likely require dispensation from the state legislature. We are a Dillon rule state. We're not a home rule state. So I'm just wondering, in Portland, do you have the, does the city have the authority on its own to make most, if not all, of these changes, or do you have to go to your legislature or put it up for a vote of the people?
Mark? Well,
Nathan, you, I think, know more about this than I do.
Yeah, we don't have to go to the state to make this change. The Charter Commission, which is made up of 20 people appointed, four appointed by each of the five members of the City Council, they actually make a vote as to whether they want to change the charter. And I can go through the enumerations of the number of people without, you know, automatically or with a vote. But at the end of the day, the city can actually act on its own without going to the state.
Okay, that's helpful. My second question is, when you talk about districts, was there any consideration given to a hybrid of, X number of districts combined with the few at large so that you'd have some people who presumably have a citywide perspective instead of a more potentially parochial or narrow outlook?
Let me just jump in on that, and I'll let Mark add to it. And I'll talk from my personal experience in the San Francisco Bay Area and having done this. And the arguments against a hybrid was that every district council member or supervisor, as they're called there, should have the overall city as their responsibility. That ultimately, when it comes to policy considerations, they need to look at the city in its totality. The notion of representing a district means that the constituents in that district have someone that they can hold accountable for something that will impact their particular district one way or another. Cities like Oakland, California has a hybrid model where there are districts and also at large, and that seems to work for them. I think at the end of the day, what it really comes down to is the chemistry and what will work in one city over another. Mark?
And to take up a bit more beyond what Nathan just said, we did consider a hybrid system. We talked about the pros and cons, much in the way that Nathan has just laid out. We talked with people up in Seattle that decided to go with a hybrid. And the thing that at least a few of us, because we didn't always agree on everything, but at least a few of us sort of thought was that the thing about a hybrid system is that it actually has the possibility of creating kind of this two-tier city council, where if you're at large, you kind of are closer to the mayor's level. And so you're in a special sort of position of thinking about the whole city, you know, and then the people in the districts are sort of just thinking about their districts, and therefore they're not to be trusted in the same sorts of ways. They're representing just that small area. And we just didn't see the logic of that. And so, yes, there is always a risk when you go to districts that any one or few of the council members could be parochial. But we're not too worried about that in Portland, to be honest. That's not the big concern. The more the concern is how well are the voices around the city of Portland being represented. And the more people being accountable to particular parts of the city, the better we are. Now, and keep in mind that multi-member systems can then shrink, they increase the size of the district, because there's multiple members for that district in the city. So, you know, city of Portland might only have three or four districts that are all multi-member. So that ends up being still pretty large parts of the city. You don't have the same concern of it being too parochial.
Okay, and my last question, thank you, is, okay, when you're talking about districts, of course, the power of the pen, districting versus gerrymandering. I mean, who draws those lines to ensure that, that the voters choose their elected officials rather than the other way around?
I'll talk about my experience again in the Bay Area. The when district elections were passed as a ballot measure, the requirements for establishing districts was placed in the ballot measure. and the requirements talked about setting up a citywide task force that identified the groups or the entities that needed to be represented on the task force. There were several iterations that were created. It was primarily driven from San Francisco State University. So it was really more the academic perspective was brought into play, and they really, the leadership there really drove the process. So they'd come out with a recommendation for, the lines to be drawn, and would go out to the general public for consideration. And they literally went through about four or five different iterations. There was a cutoff date for when they needed to complete the work. And finally, while not everyone was happy, it was not done in behind smoke-filled rooms. It was all transparent. Everyone had an opportunity to play a role.
Thank you.
Nathan answers that quite well. I do want to just jump in here because there's a question in the chat that's a clarifying question. And it's related to the question that was just asked. So I want to go ahead and get to it. And that's the difference between hybrids and multi-member districts. I'll try to keep it simple at this point. A hybrid would be, let's say, putting aside the mayor for the moment, you have, let's say, seven members of the city council. Two of them are voted for at large, and the other five are voted for in districts. And so it's a hybrid of two at large or a few at large and then others in a district. A multi-member system is one where you, let's say, have, keeping it simple, you have three districts, each with three people who will be elected from them. And in that sense, they're all still district-based, but there's multiple people from that district, and there tend to be larger districts than your normal single member districts. That's the most succinct I can get. So if you have further questions, let me know. And then Chris, I turn it back to you.
Thank you. Going in order, hands were raised. We're gonna go to Douglas, then Alistair, then Rachel. So Douglas, feel free to turn your camera on mute if you'd like, and feel free to ask your question.
Hi. Thanks, everybody, and especially thanks to Mark and Nathan for being here for us. I'm just a member of the public here, interested. I really appreciate the opportunity to join in on the Zoom. This is so interesting, and I've got so many questions. I'm gonna keep it to just two out of respect for folks' time, and if we need more, then come back to me. I like the ranked choice voting in comparison to the way voting normally works. I'm wondering if I noticed you mentioned cumulative voting. I'm wondering if you also may have considered or looked at score voting, just kind of the Amazon, give them a set number of stars to rank each person, and you can give each person as many stars as you want, you know, 1 to 5, 1 to 10, however you want to do it. That system has the advantage of being simpler in terms of you just add up the number of stars for each candidate. You don't have to go through, looking at, okay, did somebody get above 50% and then do a second round of calculations or a third round of calculations. It's easier to conceptualize. I'm wondering on the multi-member districts. In Arlington, I think, unfortunately, we have fairly geographically separated minority communities. We've got generally white folks live in the north and black and minority folks live in the south. You know, obviously, this is not by any means 100%, but general trends. And I'm wondering, Is Portland more heterogeneous in terms of the distribution of minority communities, or is it geographically clumped as well?
Mark, you want to take the first one?
Okay.
Because I think we did talk a little bit about that.
The first one, I we didn't talk a huge amount about it. There was some back and forth about sort of, what... what sort of transition would make the most sense for voters in the sense of their ability to be able to absorb it and make and understand it? And scoring in the way that you've just suggested, you know, definitely has some pluses, but as well, I mean, there'd be a lot of details to work out, but I mean, implicitly they could still all be worked out, sort of like how many stars does every voter get, right? And how they kind of how they place their stars and that kind of stuff. And in particular, can they collect them all and put them all on one candidate and someone else can distribute them across? There is something that's definitely appealing about that. And I think the best answer I can give is that even though we ultimately felt like ranked choice voting was the most straightforward and had the most pros to it, we didn't do so thinking, oh, well, these other ways of doing it just, they never work, right? They're not gonna work at all. We recognize that there's other sort of systems, cumulative voting, whatever, that you know, depending on the context, but the group had to sort of, well, no, we didn't have to. We actually almost said, you know, just something besides the normal way, first past the post voting. Let's just do something else. And then we were pushed back on actually by City Club itself, the leadership saying, you know, could you give us something a little bit more concrete? And that's when we came back and deliberated. And basically we'd already been leaning towards ranked choice voting, and that was what that was about. So that's a long way of saying, you know, some real merits to multiple types of voting systems. There's nothing inherently perfect about this one. We just think that it's a big, huge step of an improvement from, you know, from sort of first past the post traditional elections.
The only thing that I would add on that, I think Mark gave a great explanation on the way that we deliberated. There's more experience around ranked choice voting around the country and around the world. And, you know, we can learn from other, you know, jurisdictions. There's more research that's been done about the education process. Again, I've said it a few times and I can't stress it enough. The education component of this, to teach people what it's going to take to vote under a new method. So much has been done around ranked choice voting. That it becomes, I mean, quite frankly, just certainly a lot easier to educate people on that. As far as your second question, again, I've been in Portland, you know, only for a few years. Mark's got much more tenure here. It is definitely not heterogeneous. There's definitely different communities that are that have a majority African American, other immigrant communities, and the same thing holds true in again in San Francisco. It was exactly the same thing.
Yeah, actually, and I would make a slight modification to what Nathan is saying about Portland. I would say compared to either San Francisco or to Arlington, and I've lived in both areas, it is more sort of dispersed. In the city of Portland, definitely in terms of where people live in different parts of the city. But there still is sort of tendencies. It's not clumping, I would say, but tendencies in the city. And that does sort of go into the calculations that we made in terms of what might work in Portland, that very fact. But it's not as concentrated as Arlington, as I remember. And it's been a while, but still I feel like it's probably similar to what it was back then. Chris.
Yep.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, Douglas. We're going to go to Alistair. I will say we've got quite a few hands up, so let's try to all limit to one question and then we can circle back. Not appreciate your, we've had multi-part questions today, which are fantastic. And feel free to raise your hand and get back in the queue. So with that, Alistair, did you have a question? I saw your hand just went down.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, go ahead.
My question is, how would you weigh the benefits and the costs of having districted representative, local elections? Because on the face of it, I support it, but what are some downsides to it that you can think of?
Well, some of the arguments that have been waged in the past is the notion, you know, Mark mentioned it a little bit earlier, that there be competition between different districts for resources, and it would cause more division as opposed to consensus when it comes to policy that would impact the entire city. Again, that was one of the things that was presented. The other thing is, you know, people are not necessarily, you know, that amenable to embracing a change in the overall system in which they elect people. They said, oh, we've been doing it this way for so long and it works, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But again, at the end of the day, it just seems once district elections take place, it really becomes something that people do not want to give up.
Yeah, I mean, the key upside of that is some notion of accountability, and single, you know, small districts versus an at-large system really increases that, or even multi-member districts versus an at-large sort of system. The only other thing that comes to mind is that there are those, including in our current city council here in Portland, who would argue that the at-large, you know, voting makes them somehow more able conceptually, you know, intellectually able to sort of understand the rest of the city. And I don't buy that. I mean, I understand the idea of parochialism and ward politics in the old school way, which is very much an East Coast, Northeast sort of thing. But I just don't think that's the dynamic we'd see here if we moved the districts.
Thank you. We'll go to Rachel, then Nancy, Nicole, then Duke. So Rachel?
I'm sorry. Sorry, I was just trying to start my video. Well, my video doesn't want to seem to want to start.
And no worries if you don't want to start your video.
Well, it won't click off. So I'm just a member of the public, and per my comment, I was in Oregon for 28 years. And sitting here in Arlington, I just kind of want to draw us back to more of a strategic or a higher level and identify that Portland's and Oregon's vote by mail, if we're looking at inclusiveness and representation, vote by mail seems to be in its essence, it's a very simple way to vote, but it captures, easily captures these marginalized communities. And I don't know how to get that across to people here, except I think people here, we kind of had a taste of it with the pandemic. But let's not forget that part of representation is getting the community to vote. And if we make it more difficult, or if it is difficult, while we look at changing our government and our county, if the people can't vote and represent themselves, we're missing something. I'm hoping that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it does make sense. I would sort of mention for Portland, since we have the mail-in voting already, it has increased participation from marginalized communities. There's documented evidence of that. It's also increased the participation of non-marginalized communities in some respects even more. And so the gap still remains. And I think that's part of what we're trying to get to with some of the reforms that we're talking about, but only partly. I think we're also just trying to refine the notion of representation in the city of Portland and for everyone, for all the different voices. And so here I talk I'm thinking not only of demographics, but also sort of different ideological perspectives. I mean, as all of you may be familiar, Portland's been pretty up in arms, literally, in the last year of the pandemic and with our Antifa's activity in this camp in Portland and in the city. And some of that is driven by all the national events that we've had, but it's also been driven in some respects by the relationship of many younger citizens in particular in this city and their relationship to the people in power and the city council and the mayor. And so anything to improve any sort of representation and accountability seems like the right move for our city. at this point.
Thank you.
Yep.
That question. We'll go to Nancy. Oh, Nancy, you're not quite off mute. You're still on mute. There you go.
I'm a member of this Tiger Task Force, and my question is, what is it going to take to get this done? So in other words, whenever you're done with your report and all of that, there's some series of steps, but there's also the larger context. However, the current politicians feel about it, how much pushback there might be, as well as then ultimately, as Nathan's already talked about, an extensive education component, not just on ranked choice voting, but on all those different changes. So just some overview of, let's just say all your ideas are great and now you've got them. What is it going to take, and how hard or not hard would it be to actually make it happen?
I'll start, okay? We have five city council members or five commissioners. I think a majority of them are supportive of changing the form of government. I know the mayor is. Mayor is in his final term. He's termed out at the end of this round. And probably one of the most progressive or left-leaning members of the council is not in favor of it. And she has said that outright in meetings that we've had. At the end of the day, changing the form of government here means taking away the power of the purse strings that these commissioners have over their bureaus. Millions and millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, or hundreds of millions of dollars that they will no longer control. So I think at the end of the day, it needs to be wrested away from them. The Charter Commission is one method that is quote unquote the way forward to change the charter in Portland. My humble opinion is that they will not move forward on this, and this will take a ballot initiative. It'll take a grassroots effort by the business community, the labor community, the progressive community, whoever wants to, become part of a coalition to change the form of government because they don't believe it works properly. And pretty much everyone, every business person, most people in the community will agree that it's not working right. But at the end of the day, it's going to take a force or some sort of juggernaut to move it forward by collecting signatures and putting it on the ballot. That's my own opinion. I don't know how Mark feels about it, but that's the way I think this is going to shake out. The Charter Commission has until, I think, towards the end of the current year in order to make their recommendations to place a ballot initiative on the 2024 election, I believe. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much to say beyond what Nathan has just said. I think he's probably right. The Charter Commission may do some stuff around the margins, but ultimately not do the big stuff. And it would be an initiative process. So this is I think the ideas are already pretty well out there in terms of what needs to be done. So now it's just a matter of building that political pressure through an initiative process. And it would still take multiple years because, as we've all been talking about, education itself would demand that we just not sort of put this new stuff in place and just get going. There's a lot of details. So I could easily see the next decade being really about this. And that's being optimistic that, in fact, enough of citizens in Portland really are behind it.
In the Bay Area, when they passed district elections, it took 2 years of coming up with the district lines, coming up, doing the, having the groups come together, define what they should be doing. And that was placed on the ballot. After that passed on the ballot, that's when ranked choice voting was then placed on the ballot after that. So it doesn't necessarily, so overall, it takes several years, as Mark says, but it also takes several cycles, election cycles, for it to really kick in and work properly. It took about 6 years in San Francisco.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. We are going to go to Nicole, then Duke, and Beth.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for hosting this, and thank you all for calling in from Portland. I'm constantly reminded that we don't have the ability to create legislation in the state of Virginia for localities, and that we're kind of just subsidiaries of the state in creating ordinances and code, essentially. And so with that dynamic in mind, when you proposed a council, mayor, and county executive, for example, in DC, they have the mayor who acts as the executive. Have you seen examples of when a mayor has worked well with a county executive, and whether or not that county executive is a staff hire? And I know that in your case, it's legislation that's proposed by the council. Would, in your function, would the mayor be kind of part of that administration, or would they have their own policy agenda that they would be able to implement? And how would you propose that they distinguish between those authorities?
My experience, again, looking at several counties in and around the San Francisco Bay Area, whether it's Alameda County and Oakland, which also includes Berkeley or San Francisco, which is its own city and county. The mayor is elected citywide, and the mayor has all the executive functions. The city manager, or in the case, again, in San Francisco, is a chief administrative officer. That person is appointed by the mayor with confirmation by the board for a 10-year term. So that person actually transcends administrations. That is one approach. It seems to work because, again, the person that would be put forward by the mayor's office to be chief administrative officer, they're not going to do it unless it's going to pass muster with the board of supervisors. The same thing, you know, holds true in some other jurisdictions around the Bay Area. In a smaller community in South San Francisco, there's a rotating mayor, and the city manager does have much more control over the day-to-day function of government, whereas the mayor is more of the convener and the rah-rah person, but that person, that the mayor can also set the agenda for different policy efforts. So it really is, you know, it's hit or miss depending on the size of the city and you know, what is palatable to the current, you know, makeup of the body politic, which is not just the elected officials, but civic leaders as well. That's just from my limited experience in this whole area.
I mean, the only thing I'd add is that what I have seen, and it's mostly in California as well, but also a little bit on the East Coast, is that, you know, mayors who have an executive function, and they do almost by definition, if they are out of line, if they're pushing their own agenda, if they're kind of not working with their city manager, the city manager always has the ability to go to the rest of the council, the legislative body, and say, this isn't working. So, you know, it's like the federal government, right? I mean, if the bureaucracy is having a problem with the president, what do? They go to Congress and they try to work through Congress. I think that's those same sort of functions play out in the kind of systems that we're familiar with and that we're talking about.
You know, cities like San Francisco and Oakland have what's called the strong mayor form of government, where the mayor has certain, you know, powers that some people contest, and the city council or the board of supervisors consistently tries to chip away at the powers. And most of those powers are about appointing commissioners to different functions, whether it's the Public Utilities Commission, whether it's the Planning Commission. In the past, the mayor would be able to appoint his or her designee for those commissions. The chipping away of the strong mayor form of government is really about allowing the council or the Board of Supervisors to make their own appointments or having them approve the mayor's appointment to those commissions. That's really where the rubber hits the road when it comes to implementing the policies that a mayor gets elected upon.
Thank you. Next up, we've got Duke.
Yes. good evening, and thank you, Nate and Mark, for coming and participating on this. I want to follow up with what Nancy Tate had mentioned about the difficulties of implementing this, and on two points. One is, what other community allies do you have in your efforts, like Chamber of Commerce or other groups that might, you know, that are supportive of what you're saying in terms of, you know, creating a buzz to in support of this? You focus on the city count, on the city commissioners and that dynamic in terms of, you know, how this might play out. But what are the role of the political parties, if any, on this dynamic, like especially the Democratic Party, which I presume is predominant in Portland and other parties? All of this is basically finding out how, you know, what is the best effective lobbying technique you can have to get the thing implemented.
Well, I mean, I think I would simply say that everything that I've noticed has suggested that the two parties have stayed out of things. These are, you know, nonpartisan elections, and the parties are focused elsewhere for the most part. Now, I could be wrong, and there may be a need to focus on the parties, for example, in an initiative process. But at this point, I haven't seen them as being big players in all of this. Nathan can maybe talk a little bit more about the business community, because he knows it, I think, better than I in terms of their relationship to this. I would simply say that there have been a lot of nonprofit organizations around Portland that, you know, City Club is working with or trying to work with in the BIPOC community, who are, you know, who are critical to actually moving this forward. Their support is going to be a big part of this, and there already is some support in some of these community organizations. But a lot of this as well is sort of how this is framed for the public at large, because ultimately the public opinion on this in Portland is going to really matter. And if those who don't want changes continue to use the frame of, well, let's keep Portland weird and we'll just do it the way we've always done it, and it works for Portland, even if it doesn't work for everybody else, if that's embraced enough by citizens in Portland, we're not going to see change ultimately. But if enough citizens are saying, no, we need to make these changes and make our city council more accountable, that could actually be really helpful.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, you know, it's a matter of trust that has to be created between different interest groups. And it's not really partisan. It's more ideology. So a far left progressive might want to see the change because they just want to see, they don't trust, you know, someone being elected, you know, citywide, and they want someone that they know that can, you know, carry their flag. At the same time, there might be someone from the business community that says, I don't think that, you know, these people that currently should be, you know, managing sums of money in bureaus that they know nothing about. In the same breath, there could be a developer that says, you know what, I like only going to one person and having that one person make the decision. So at the end of the day, it's really about building a coalition. It's not an easy lift. It takes a lot of work, but more than anything else, it takes a lot of trust. I go back to when Mark and I were involved in putting together our report. You know, we had tried to engage with varying members of the community, marginalized members of the community. And one of the meetings that we went to, you know, there was a lot of distrust just from the fact that we were representing the City Club, because people had their own, you know, perceptions and perspective on what the City Club is, who their membership, what their membership is made up of, and what their intentions are. So the whole notion of really getting out into the community and creating coalitions and building trust is probably the only way to really move this thing forward, unless the and finding leaders that are willing to, you know, take a lot of heat because they want to see change for the good of the city. Portland cannot grow to be the kind of city I believe it can be without forming its change, without changing its form of government.
Thank you. We'll go to Beth next.
Hi, I'm Beth Grossman. I also work with the Tiger Task Force. I was wondering, when you were looking at multi-member districts with ranked choice voting, did you consider as an alternative having at-large ranked choice voting, or did you feel like Portland's just too big a city, either in terms of population or geography, for that?
I mean, what I would say is that we tried to deal with each of our different reform options sort of separately initially. So we thought about, at least briefly, about, you know, at large ranked choice voting, thought about, you know, districts, but doing it with, you know, first past the post, traditional sort of electoral methods, and went through those. And each time, you know, found ourselves moving towards districts and towards ranked choice voting, or with an acknowledgement of other voting possibilities, you know, other methods being viable, but just not our preferred choice. And it just felt like it went well to move in that direction across all of these criteria. I mean, part of it was moving away from primaries, but we could do that with ranked choice and keep it at large. But then the at large part was, we struggled with representation and how well we thought at large does at representation. One of the things that we haven't mentioned that we did in this analysis is that we looked at where people were elected from, where they lived basically in Portland. And you go back over 40 years of the commissioners and where they're from. And with, you know, a few exceptions, they're all from Southwest Portland. And Southwest Portland is higher income, less diverse. Well, actually, it's got pockets of diversity, but higher income, generally speaking, you know, much more professional background in terms of careers and that kind of jobs and that kind of stuff. And it just wasn't, on the face of it, just wasn't representative of the different parts of the city. And so part of what districts would at least bring, because people would be expected to be living in their districts, is at least some of that sense of connection. It's not a perfect system by any means.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Thank you. Next up, I think Jerry.
Yes. This is kind of a follow-up on a question that John Weisted asked before. He asks about this, if you had any recommendations about the rules or guidelines or standards that would be used in drawing district lines. And I don't know that you answered that. I'm particularly interested in, for instance, some jurisdictions use compactness or keeping communities of interest together or not dividing up communities of interest. Do you have any standards like that for drawing the district lines?
The experience that I can attest to, and I could send it to Chris and you can see it online as well. The ballot measure that was passed in San Francisco was very specific, talking about the number of people that need to, the minimum number of people that needs to define a district. So it was about numbers of population with an emphasis about keeping communities that are inherently together, keeping them together and not dividing them. So there were certain guidelines that were put in place for drawing the lines. And again, those lines have been redrawn you know, they're actually doing it right now with modest permutations, again, based upon population, people moving in and out. There's one district, is District 10, which historically has been an African-American district where there have been more and more Asian immigrants moving into that district where it's no longer considered an African-American centric district. It's become a lot more diverse. So at the end of the day, I mean, I could send it to Chris and he can pass it around. There is criteria that comes up in the actual ballot initiative that says what the criteria would be for drawing those lines. And, it seems to have worked. I hope that answers your question, Jerry.
Thank you. I want to go to Sharon and then Michael.
Yes, thanks, Chris. And I know Mark said he would address community input or engagement if there's time available at the end of this presentation. So thank you. Michael.
Sorry, am I up?
Yes, sorry, yep, you are up.
Sorry, hi, thanks so much for coming. It's fascinating, your work. How are you stopping primaries? We have nonpartisan school board elections, but the Democratic Party insists on endorsing candidates in caucuses. How do you stop your political parties from using their First Amendment rights to endorse the candidates that they want to endorse and essentially, So we're stuck on this issue here. You've made some comments that I don't understand, saying that single member districts are less divisive than multi-member districts if they're both using ranked choice voting. I don't get that. I also don't get the statement that multi-member districts are better at getting diversity than at large ranked choice voting and STV approaches. So those are my three things I'd like feedback on. I don't understand.
So real quick, if I said this, then it was a misquote on my part. Multi-member districts tend to reduce conflict in campaigning over single-member districts, definitely. So it's the reverse of what you suggested that I had said. And if I did, I apologize for that.
Even if they're both ranked choice voting?
Huh?
Even if they're both ranked choice voting?
Even if they're both ranked choice, yeah, it actually reduces. Now, maybe only marginally some more given ranked choice voting, but yes, I think so. So
I think your first, well, let me just jump to your first question, Michael. When you talked about, Democratic Party and primaries, look, once you change the charter and you talk about the way that voting is going to be done, that's it. It's done. So the endorsements of candidates and the endorsements of initiatives, whether they come from the business community, the Chamber of Commerce, the Democratic Party, whatever influencer there is in the city, they have their First Amendment right. They're going to come out and they're either going to support it or they're going to go against it. Given, depending on how much money they have, they'll have their own campaign to either support it or kill it. Again, at the end of the day, in my experience has been, if you have the resources to get your message out consistently and effectively and transparent in a way that's transparent and not a negative way, got a good chance of winning. It takes a lot of money though. It takes a lot of money.
And just to follow up, I mean, I think, Michael, our situation in Portland is very different than Arlington in terms of the parties. The parties, whether it's school board, whether it's city council, I mean, there may be stuff happening kind of behind closed doors, sort of casual stuff, supporting, getting the word around and in the party, but for the most part, they really stay out of that. They're focused on statewide office is their big thing. Holding the legislature for the party, for the Democratic Party in particular, it's just not something that I have seen. I've got at least one friend who's run and one on school board here, and I've never seen evidence of that. I think there was a third question there, but I'm also aware of time. So Chris, let me ask you a question. How much longer do we go? Because I know that Sharon had her question about citizen engagement, and I don't know.
Yeah, so I think if there are, I was taking a look at the chat. I do think there's one question that John asked that I don't think has been addressed that's directly on point. And then at that point, if there are no questions that are directly on point to tonight's topic, then I think, you know, responding to Sharon's question would be appropriate. Because at this point, with the lack of, if there are no other questions, we would go ahead and wrap. So I'll just read John's question. And it's three questions. So I'll take it in pieces. Are you proposing synchronous elections with mayor and city council people all elected at once or staggered terms? Why don't I do one at a time? So I'll let you all react to that.
Staggered,
okay.
But it's not a formal recommendation that existed in the report.
Oh, so that's what's interesting is that Nathan and Nathan is probably right because he checks this in closer than I do. I thought we had not that we had formally recommended this, but that it was sort of generally understood that it made more sense if they weren't staggered. But we never talk about that in the report. And I don't think that that's really on the agenda right now. I just personally, maybe this is my own bias showing up. I tend to lean towards non-staggered. And so that's a separate conversation potentially, but he, you know, Nathan's probably right is that it'll remain staggered. And by the way, I'm realizing now, Chris, that I went in the chat and I did answer
John's
questions. I just did it much farther down.
Okay. Got you. Sorry. I was scrolling up and then, okay. So yeah, John, if you're in good shape, then do not feel the need to.
Term limits. Well, there's term limits for mayor. Nathan's already mentioned this, but not for council members. As far as I know, term limits for council not being talked about. And there's been no talk that I've seen about compensation for the amount of work that would eventually maybe be conversation, but I don't think it's been talked about by us at all.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. So I do see a hand up, Stuart.
Yes, I just wanted to ask you about on the multi-member districts. I'm assuming that these are always or almost always distinct districts rather than any sort of overlap between different districts.
Yes.
So they are distinct. And the other question is, the other part of the question is there any examples where in local government, multi-member districts is working well or a good example of it or where it doesn't? Or thank you. And thank you very much for coming and doing this.
Yeah, Nathan, do you have a sense of a particular district that comes to mind? I mean, I'm trying to think.
I'm sorry, Stuart, could you just say, ask the question one more time? I was a little distracted, I'm sorry.
You answered the part about the distinct districts, but I was just wondering about examples of multi-member districts in localities where they are particularly good examples of them working, or if there's anywhere where there's more difficulty with that.
Yeah, honestly, I am not familiar with at least in my experience with any multi-member districts. Again, the San Francisco is 7 by 7 miles, 49 square miles. It is relatively small and dense. There's 11 districts. Population is a little over 800, about close to 900,000 people that are residents. So 11 districts, you know, you can do the math yourself. And they all have one single representative. So, I mean, I'm just not familiar with any multi-member jurisdictions with multi-member districts.
So, I mean, this gets at an important point, which does, you know, it's been raised in a few different questions, at least indirectly, is that I, on the tip of my tongue, I'm like thinking, you know, is it Charlotte, North Carolina, or somewhere else? I'm trying to remember where a city where they have multi-member districts that I've read about. But this gets at an important point, you know, a caveat, right, to our work, which is that, you know, we have theoretical reasons, right, to argue for multi-member districts. And I've got some scholarly arguments as a political scientist that I can and am making. But it's not like this is a this is not like ranked choice voting, which has really gained a lot of credibility in other parts of the world and other parts of the US. This is something where there's been some talk about it. There's some places where it's occurred. Some of them are not in the US. And so I can get back to Chris and Dave with a couple of, you know, districts that I've, but I'll have to look them up because I'm not remembering anything in particular. But that, so that's the caveat. We're not talking about something that is as widely used. And so that's worth keeping in mind.
Well, we can go to Dave. And then I think I don't see any other hands. Oh, we've got John back. Okay, so Dave and then John.
Well, I would think of Cambridge as a multi-member district. I mean, it's the whole city,
but
it's 130,000 people. There's 9 council members, so it really is, and it's been remarkably successful at getting all the major communities in the city represented on city council and on school board. Even when you had really highly racially polarized voting in Massachusetts, Cambridge successfully got African Americans onto their city council since the 70s, with a African American population in the city about 10-12%. It was very functionally very like what would happen in a multi-member district in a portion of Portland or a portion of Arlington.
Okay, so yeah, it would have some of the same dynamics because of how they're elected, mm-hmm. structure of how they're elected, being similar to what you would find in a multi-member district. I can get examples. I just can't think of examples right off the, looks like someone, Keith, has said that the Alexandria City School Board has multi-member districts. So there are, I mean, there are examples. Maybe there are more school board examples out there than there are the sort of examples that we're talking about. Okay, thanks.
So we're gonna go with John and then circle back to Sharon's question about public mechanisms. And
sure.
I'm sorry. Yeah, John, we'll start with you, then go to Sharon. And we don't have any more questions up to Sharon. We'll wrap up for the evening.
Okay, John? Great. Yeah, I just want to go actually back to a question that Doug MacGyver put into the chat, which is a great question. So if you dispense with primaries, is there any filter for a candidate to be culled or screened out before they get to the general election? And in other words, I don't know that it's a risk necessarily, but you know, you could have the phenomenon of what, 25, 50, 75 candidates, just like in the campaign to take out Governor Newsom in California. You know, you got everybody and his or her uncle running, and, you know, you'd have a tremendously long ballot, and it might take a lot of money for people to, you know, stand out from the crowd. How about that dynamic?
I'll just talk a little bit again. I'll just draw upon some experience. The criteria for getting your name on the ballot. So, you know, there's all sorts of folks that ran for mayor in San Francisco that I knew of when Gavin Newsom ran for mayor. And, you know, I mean, some real whack jobs, some real crazy folks. And what it ultimately, the way that the director of elections, the criteria was on contributions, campaign contributions, that you had to reach a certain threshold, not of public money, but of money that was given into the, you know, it's kind of like the debates, the Democratic debates for the 20, you know, for the last election. You had to reach a certain threshold of contributions in order to qualify to be placed on the ballot. That was one, that's one example of limiting the, you know, the number of people that can actually get on to the ballot for the election.
Well, what is Portland mulling on this topic, if anything?
I don't believe we've talked about it, but Mark?
No, I mean, we haven't talked about it, but keep in mind, John, that there's sort of another filter, which is that the people themselves ranking their preferences. It would be highly unusual for someone who is, you know, just way, way, way outside the mainstream, you know, getting more than, I don't know, 30% support in first round, and also getting sufficient support in the second round or third round of counting to be able to get above 50%. It's not like a system where first past the post. It's not Arnold Schwarzenegger in California in a special election where he can win an election without getting 50% of the vote, because it's all broken, you know, in terms of different people. It's the ranked choice really takes care of that. That's the power in my mind of ranked choice. That does the filtering without it having to be done in two different elections. You do it all at once, more people are involved, and you get a candidate who wins, or candidates who win, who are more likely to truly represent the set of interests in the district.
You know, the Department of Elections can say, okay, we're going to take the, you know, we're going to have 10 choices on the ballot, and those 10 choices will, you know, you need to qualify to be one of those 10 choices. You know, that again, that becomes something that becomes part of the public policy and the determination of who gets on the ballot. If someone says, all right, you know, anyone that takes out papers and gets enough signatures to qualify to run, then, you know, you can have a list of 50 people. But again, at the end of the day, as Mark says, ranked choice voting takes care of that for you. You know, people take their elections pretty seriously, as you know. When it comes right down to the general election, people, if they're voting, they're pretty serious about what they're doing, generally speaking.
Thank you.
So, Dave, I see your hand. Do you have a quick one, or?
Mark and Nathan really took care of the points I was trying to make. I've seen, you know, the nutballs get eliminated in the general election in Cambridge, and I think that would be what you'd expect to happen.
Well, Mark, this will be. I don't see any other hands up. So, if you want to circle back to the public mechanisms or public engagement question, I'm sure our chair of our subcommittee on public engagement would appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, what I think I'm going to do, Chris, is I'll give a brief response right now, and then maybe try to follow up to you and to Dave with a written response that maybe can be forwarded to Sharon and to anybody else who, you know, wants to hear about it.
Great.
Basically, you know, Portland is a city like many cities that has multiple forms of engagement. And the real question for us right now, in a lot of ways, is how do you sort of lower the cost of engagement for as many people as possible? That's part of what we're getting to here, is lowering the cost for people. So, you know, one example was given earlier about mail-in voting in Oregon. Well, that's a huge part of what mail-in voting is, part of its appeal, is that it actually lowers that cost. So we're thinking about things related to that as well here. But community engagement to me is about much more than voting. Voting is certainly something we're trying to improve in Portland. But community engagement is also about communication with the city leaders and with the city overall. And there, I mean, I would say that, you know, some of it works through community organizations. We have a growing number of community organizations that are actively interacting with the city, you know, BIPOC community, but other groups as well. So you have that sort of standard attempts at communication. And there are these different processes by which people can give their input. This is a very input-oriented city. Now, does that mean that that input is always going to be listened to or is mostly listened to? That's a separate sort of question. But certainly the access is there. So whether it's Bureau of Transportation issues, which is one that gets a lot of participation from regular citizens, or it's other issues around police reform, you know, there are these mechanisms for getting your perspective to the city. This is also a protest city. This is also a city that people take to the streets and they march and go even beyond marching, quite honestly. And I fit this into the citizen engagement, right? This is highly engaged citizens who are out there collecting in our city parks and then marching into downtown. And this was happening all last summer. And this, I think, is gonna only pick up speed again this summer here. So, you know, is this a city where the city leaders listen to or try to listen to citizens? I think they do pretty well. Do they do it effectively in terms of really hearing from a wide variety of perspectives in the city? I think that's where the weakness continues to be. And the more accountable they are, honestly, to those different voices in the city, the more likely they are to listen. So community engagement to me is sort of the two-way street between accountability and actually expressing voice, citizens expressing voice. So that's the quick kind of reaction to community engagement. I'm happy to put more in writing.
Let me just add one other quick thing, just again, based upon some experience. And actually, you know, I do some consulting work and I'm doing this in Berkeley right now. So the city of Berkeley, again, very progressive city, lots of, you know, left-leaning, quote-unquote left-leaning ideas, Green Party activity, et cetera, et cetera. At the end of the day, the members of the city council, even though they represent districts, they focus on policy and they reach out to the community on policy over and over and over again, you know, whether it's through the commissions, whether it's town hall meetings, and I've seen this work. They just really engage in a way where they're able to, you know, really come up with policy decisions that they debate, you know, fairly well. At the end of the day, once they pass a piece of legislation or a resolution, it's the city's manager's job to implement it. And it really, it really shows how things can actually work. Where you, when your focus is policy and the policy for the betterment of your city and the constituents that you represent, and then having someone implement that policy, all of a sudden, I think you start seeing things a little bit differently. And, you know, something that Berkeley just passed, they passed it, a big housing initiative that no one ever thought that they would pass. And it was about transit-oriented development, and there's a big development that was passed with no parking, you know, but heavy duty on affordable housing. No one thought it was ever going to pass, and again, it did because they worked on it for a while. But it was the community input from every side that actually made it happen.
Well, on that note, I don't see any more hands. I don't see any more new questions in the chat. So I want to say on behalf of Tiger, thank you to our fantastic speakers this evening, Nathan and Mark. I really appreciate everything. Sorry, I'm multitasking and I shouldn't be on the chat. I want to say thank you so much for bringing your experience to Tiger and to Arlington County, and really, I'm confident in all the offers of additional information you've made tonight, but also I'm sure we'll be calling on you both in the future, and so I just want to say thank you so much
Closing out for the evening, we are off, so to speak. We've been having some Monday sessions, so we will not be meeting for a public forum on Memorial Day. We will resume our series on June 7th with a roundtable on Arlington's government electoral systems. And so we'll have more information available at civfed.org/committee/tiger. And we'll be pushing out information about upcoming upcoming forums. So thank you, Tiger members, members of the public, for your thoughtful questions and engagement this evening. And I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Portland.
Thanks, Chris.
Good night, everyone. Thank you.